From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, journalist Sarah Kendzior explains how President Trump uses rallies to galvanize his base. Then we explore why the Democratic National Convention is heading to Wisconsin.
President Trump winning Wisconsin for the first time a Republican had in 30 years, that's all a big deal and it's all symbolic, and I think Democrats are choosing Milwaukee because they want to say we still care about this part of the country and it's important to us.
We'll have some tips on how to keep your car tuned up in the cold weather, and our How Did You Do That series digs into the things you don't think about when starting up a law firm.
I think every client we thought for sure would follow us didn't, and everyone we didn't think would come did. It was really, I think we were really, really surprised. The clients that we thought would be nearly impossible to get were some of the first that came over.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. Since winning the 2016 election, President Trump has continued to hold rallies in cities throughout the country. Last night, he held one in Milwaukee to the delight and dread of people in the area. There were protests, of course, as has become the custom. And there were the familiar faces of the Front Row Joes, a group of mostly retirees who go from one Trump rally to the next, kind of like deadheads with a political bent. The scene itself has become familiar over the past few years, but journalist Sarah Kendzior says these events are anything but politics as usual. Kendzior is the co-host of the Gaslit Nation podcast, and she's an expert on authoritarianism. She joins us from Missouri, where she lives. Sarah Kendzior, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So, this is kind of a bigger question beyond Trump, but how do politicians tend to use rallies? What is their purpose, theoretically?
I mean, theoretically, rallies are used during times of campaigns when they need to get the public's attention, when they need to get the public's approval. With Trump, it's been different because the rallies from the campaign never stopped. And I think that that has to do with Trump's drive to dominate the news cycle at any cost. You know, he has these means of one-sided communication, whether it's his Twitter feed, the lack of press conferences, or these campaign rallies in which he has full control over what he says. And he knows that the media will just reprint it. You know, if he lies, the lie may end up in a headline. And so for him, that's extremely advantageous.
Yeah, that's one of the biggest questions I've had as someone who's, you know, followed along with other political campaigns. Usually when the campaign is over, the rallies stop, but his have just continued.
Oh, they need to, because Trump has based, you know, his movement, his cult, basically, around the kind of, you know, motivations that any demagogue has, where he always has to be in a battle. He always has to be in the process of vanquishing an enemy, because that's the sort of action, you know, the sort of vengefulness and spite, you know, that fills his movement. If they actually win, if he actually completes something, then he loses the momentum behind it. And I think there's also a greater sense of obligation. And so he wants people to be, you know, swept up into this continual drama. Like, I'm someone who, you know, I grew up watching professional wrestling, and, you know, a lot of it reminds me of that. He needs to come out. He needs to be this character. He needs to get the crowd engaged in the drama. He needs to proclaim his enemies. But obviously, this is incredibly dangerous when you're not in a reality TV show or a, you know, pro wrestling show, but you're acting as a head of state with autocratic ambitions, trying to, you know, at the same time get himself exonerated from all of the crimes, you know, that he's been accused of committing.
So I'd like to take a quick step back. You've actually been to a Trump rally, at least one that I know of, perhaps more. You've waited in line with people. You've gotten to know people a little bit. What is that experience like?
I mean, it was back in 2015, 2016, when I was covering the campaign, that I would go to the rallies, you know, both in Missouri and in Illinois. I think things have changed since, because at that time, a lot of people were there just out of curiosity. You know, the reason that they knew of Trump was The Apprentice. They saw him as a reality TV star. Some of them saw him as like a tycoon, as a businessman. They really bought into his promises about the economy. There were other people who were there, you know, because they were attracted to the worst things about him, his bigotry, his xenophobia, his hatefulness. But it was really kind of a mix of people. What I did notice and what alarmed me greatly at the time was that, you know, in line, people were calm, people were polite. And once they reached that arena, once they were inside of Trump, he would bring out people's worst impulses. And I went to one of the most violent Trump rallies of that year of 2016 in St. Louis. I think like 16 people were injured. And it was so easy to watch that crowd turn into a mob, and to watch people who had been treating each other with consideration and kindness just begin screaming the most virulent, hateful, awful things. And that's frightening. That's the kind of thing that Trump seeks to cultivate, and his campaign team seeks to cultivate it, and the people surrounding him do. It's not something they see as negative in any way. They, in fact, see it as essential to keeping his power strong.
You've called it, in fact, a study in mob mentality. And as someone who hasn't been to one of these rallies, it sounds incredibly dangerous when you phrase it that way.
Yes, it is dangerous. It's the kind of thing you would see in any kind of demagogue turned dictatorship. It's the kind of phenomenon you see in cults. And I think it's gotten worse over the past 4 years. You know, a lot of people like to say that 40% of the country approves of Trump or voted for Trump. But I've always drawn a distinction between the voters and the base. A lot of the voters are disillusioned people who didn't like either of the candidates. There were people who weren't paying a particularly large amount of attention to the news. There were people who were duped both by the news, which really played down Trump's history of criminality, and duped by Trump himself. And then there's the base, who were conspiratorial, vicious, paranoid, and have grown even more so. They've bought into Trump's delusions. They've bought into his delusion of grandeur, and he needs that. And I think as this base has shrunk over time, it's become more fanatical. You know, there's sort of a sunk cost here where they've devoted so much of their life to supporting him and believing in him. And this kind of extends into the QAnon cult as well, that to turn away from it is a loss of identity, a loss of self. And that's a frightening phenomenon. I don't think it's a very large percentage of the country that feels this level of attachment to Trump. You know, I would think it's like probably under 5%. But we've had incidences, you know, the MAGA bomber, various people who've threatened others, particularly immigrants or non-white Americans, in Trump's name. It cultivates a culture of violence. And that's what I'm worried about, is, you know, less of the anger and more how does that translate into, you know, physical attacks, into assaults, into intimidation of innocent fellow Americans.
You know, these people who are very big fans of Donald Trump, they make up a fair amount, it seems, of the rally goers. They, in fact, call themselves front row Joes. Has that changed a lot since you started covering these rallies?
Well, I haven't been back to one since he won. You know, I feel like, honestly, the media should be covering these rallies less. I think they give them too much attention. It's an opportunity for Trump to spread propaganda. So I can't say, you know, firsthand whether there's some sort of difference in who's showing up. But I will say that one thing I do notice in the media coverage are the same faces again and again. We've had situations, you know, where newspapers like the New York Times have accidentally interviewed the same fans over and over. And so I think, you know, what he's got going on here is not some sort of organic uprising, but, you know, it's kind of like a dictator version of a Grateful Dead show, where like people are kind of traveling around state to state. You know, there are people hawking merchandise. There are people there for all sorts of reasons. And there are, you know, Trump fanatics. And I think that was inevitable, given his, you know, demagoguery, given his style of speaking, given the fact that he was a celebrity beforehand, and one that's very good at PR, very good at propaganda, and, you know, now is in a position of political power. You know, this is not like a, you know, unprecedented phenomenon, certainly in politics.
You spoke a little bit to this about what the media sometimes gets wrong as far as these rallies go. What do people get wrong about them in general? What do people misunderstand, perhaps?
I mean, back when I was covering it 4 years ago, the main thing the media missed is how dangerous not just the rallies could be, but Trump could be. You know, he came out and launched his campaign by calling Mexicans rapists and murderers. He then proclaimed that he was going to enact an autocratic agenda. He lied incessantly, and people treated it like it was a joke. They didn't take it seriously. They didn't condemn it. They didn't look into his decades of documented criminal ties, ties to the Kremlin, all of these things that were like blaring warning signs. And, you know, when I would bring them up, I would be called alarmist or hysterical or be told, you know, why are you taking him seriously? He has no chance to win. This is how to win. You know, Trump came out of reality TV. He came out of tabloid media. He's always been good at winning over an audience. And the audience that he's best at winning over is the coastal media, is the New York media, because he's a creature of that world. And I think that that media, which often likes to see itself as sort of above these things, really fell for him and really was duped in a lot of respects. And what they're doing now, I think, with the rallies is using the Midwest in particular, you know, using the Midwest and the South as a kind of proxy for their own fanatic devotion to Trump. You know, they may not like his policies, they may not like him, but he is a moneymaker for them. They seem very intimidated by him. And I think when they go out and they find some, you know, allegedly random Trump fan like out here in Missouri or something, they can then use that person as a proxy to kind of express what I see as their own loyalty and devotion to Trump. It's a kind of way of doing access journalism by proxy. And I think it's disrespectful to this region, you know, where they show very little interest otherwise, unless it's Trump-centered. And it's incredibly dangerous as a form of propaganda because it puts out this myth that he's this great populist figure where he really isn't. You know, he's a cult leader, and his cult, while loud, is small.
As someone who was born and raised in Wisconsin, I will say it gets frustrating when media on either coast tend to focus on just one sort of picture of the Midwest. Like, we'll have huge snowstorms, we'll have these catastrophic events that get almost no coverage, and then, you know, the moment that an election comes around, now they're at diners, now they're in our hometowns.
Yeah, it's frustrating. My in-laws live in Wisconsin, and so, you know, they've been watching this kind of onslaught of the press, you know, of the coastal press, the national press, who otherwise show very little consideration. You know, while, of course, local media is gutted, you know, that's true of the Midwest, that's true of the South, it's true of most of the country. And so there is this really dehumanizing aspect. And, you know, I think Trump knows how to capitalize on that aspect. He did that successfully in 2016. I have a lot of questions, you know, about how this election went down, about the integrity of it, the fairness of it. But one thing that's been driving me crazy in terms of your state of Wisconsin is that he won by such a narrow margin. And he won because in part of voter suppression, because about 200,000 people were turned away at the polls. And then his margin of victory was like 30,000 people. And yet there's this tendency in the coastal press to go to Wisconsin and see it as like Trump land, see it as Trump territory, instead of a state that is, you know, a mix of people, of ideologies, of demography, you know, the same as my state, the same as Missouri. It's so easy for them to kind of get away with it. And it's very frustrating. I think we need to push back. We need to fight back, like from here in the Midwest, in the heartland, these kind of stereotypical portrayals.
Wisconsin is quintessentially a purple state. You know, I'll say, as somebody who grew up in a very red part of the state, I now live in a very blue part of the state. And even inside of those pockets, you still know a lot of people on either side of politics. Mm-hmm. Going on to kind of how Trump compares to other politicians, you know, you mentioned rallies. These kinds of things are not uncommon for politicians. How does Trump compare to other U.S. politicians?
Oh, gosh. I mean, that's That's a broad statement. You know, people have, there's been a history of demagoguery in the United States. There's also just been a history of, you know, powerful speakers. Yeah, I would say Obama, Bill Clinton, you know, on the Democratic side fall into this category. We've seen what happens when the other side does not have, I think, like natural campaigners. Like Hillary Clinton was, you know, eminently qualified for the presidency, but she herself said, you know, she's not a great campaigner. She was not somebody who enjoyed that kind of spotlight and could command a crowd. In that regard, you know, I think our media culture has changed things. I think the digital era has changed the way a demagogue can command attention. You know, one thing I see Trump doing both at rallies and sometimes at interviews is putting in these kind of asides that seem random at the time. You know, I remember one of them was him proclaiming, "I am the chosen one." And he kind of did this randomly in an interview about something else. And I thought he's doing that so that his team can create a meme out of that, so that they could create chopped up, decontextualized digital content and then, you know, share it with the world that way. They're very savvy about this. I mean, they're savvy in a very dangerous, often illegal way, you know, through their work with groups like Cambridge Analytica and other data mining firms. But I think the modern candidate, they're not just speaking to the rally in the present time. You know, they're looking at how is this going to be reallocated into the future? How is this going to live on the internet? And of course, you know, in the past, people would think about this. They think, how will my words be used later? But usually, you know, once a rally happened, once an event happened, that would be it. You know, you wouldn't have somebody picking through it 5 years later, trying to find quotable lines, trying to find gaffes. I think nowadays, there's a different sense of temporality. There's a different sense of how words can be weaponized, both by the candidate and against the candidate. And Trump's team is unfortunately pretty good at figuring out what his base wants to hear.
Well, Sarah Kendzior, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing so much of your work.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Sarah Kendzior is a Missouri-based journalist and the author of The View from Flyover Country, a collection of her essays. Kendzior is also the co-host of the Gaslit Nation podcast. We'll take a short break now, then our Wisconsin 2020 series explores some listener questions about the impending Democratic National Convention. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The Trump rally and the Bucks game yesterday had many commuters dreading their ride home. But that was nothing. This July, the Democratic National Convention is expected to bring tens of thousands of people to the city of Milwaukee, and many Milwaukeeans aren't sure what to expect. As part of our Wisconsin 2020 series, we've been asking you, our listeners, to tell us what you want to know about the DNC. And many of you have done just that. Molly Beck is a state government and politics reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and she's here to answer some of those questions. Molly Beck, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thanks for having me.
So local journalists have been talking about the DNC really since it was announced that it'll be coming to Milwaukee. But I think there's still a lot of confusion about what it means for the city. So let's unpack some of this and start with a truly basic question here. What is the DNC?
The DNC, as we know it, is the convention, and that's where about 50,000 people are going to come to Milwaukee, and it's where the next Democratic presidential candidate will be picked. And so that person will go on to compete one-on-one against President Trump.
In the timeline of the election process, when does the DNC happen? What comes before it, and what do we expect after it?
So the Wisconsin presidential primary is not until April, and there are a lot of other state contests in the on the Democratic side until coming up before that, including the Iowa caucuses, which are coming up in about 20 days, and then Super Tuesday, where a bunch of states will hold their primaries. New Hampshire's in there, too. So before Wisconsin's primary, which I think is the first or second week of April, there will be a bunch of other states that make their decisions before that. And then there will be some after us, too. But the DNC, which happens in mid-July, will be kind of the culmination of that, where the person is picked.
So theoretically, we have all of these primaries, and by the time we get to the DNC, we really know who's going to be nominated, but who does the nomination?
So, and actually this year, you know, usually by the time the convention comes around, you have a good idea of who the nominee is going to be. But this year, there are a lot of Democratic candidates that are still going strong. Obviously, that I expect that will change after Iowa, after New Hampshire, after Super Tuesday. So, but we're still expecting probably a few candidates to making a play for Wisconsin in April. So usually there won't be, you know, some sort of contested convention or brokered convention or anything like that. But barring that, rarity, it's just the delegates that will make their decision. And those delegates, some of them are pledged delegates, and they are making their pick based on the results of the primary election.
Are these the same people who, back in 2016, many of us called superdelegates?
So there's two kinds of delegates. There's regular delegates and there's superdelegates. The superdelegates, their power has been scaled back, and they really only come into play if there's a deadlock. So the delegates are the ones that are picked by the party, and they're the ones who are really going to probably make the decision.
Okay. So when we're talking about the DNC and the event that's happening here in Milwaukee, what all does that include? What happens there?
So there's the convention, which is going to be at Fiserv Forum, but there's also going to be hundreds of other events. And actually, there's going to be things happening elsewhere in the state, and probably in Madison. I've heard some journalists are staying in the Green Bay area. And there are also some people staying in even Illinois. So there's going to be a lot of different events happening all over the state during those few days in July.
Well, and I think this is a thing that a lot of Wisconsinites especially have been interested in. Who can go to the DNC? If you're, you know, somebody who happens to live in the Milwaukee area, is interested in attending, can you do that?
It's unlikely that just somebody off the street will be able to actually come to the convention, but if you are a delegate, if you're a journalist, if you are a volunteer, if you're an elected official in the Democratic Party, I mean, those are the people that are really going to be there. There's really going to be a lot of journalists and a lot of volunteers aside from the political people that will be there.
Well, and that gets to another question people have. If you want to volunteer, how do you go about doing that?
So the DNC's website has a application, and I have heard from some people who wish to volunteer that they haven't heard anything back from the DNC, but DNC officials say they're working on that and they're going to get back to them soon.
Well, and we have some time, right?
Right.
So people who live in the city, people who work in the city, they have certainly mixed feelings about the DNC. What is it going to mean for people who live and work down here?
Yeah, I think traffic's going to be crazy. I would expect that. If you're interested in renting out your home on Airbnb, you're probably going to make a lot of money during those few days in July. Restaurants are going to be making a lot of money, but that also means there's going to be a lot of people probably around in downtown Milwaukee. And like I said, it's around 50,000 that they're expecting. So that's a pretty big group of people coming.
My boyfriend keeps trying to convince me to rent out our house on Airbnb. but we have two dogs and two cats, so I'm not sure
where you're gonna
how
go.
That would work. Yeah. So this is a big question. And this is a question that I think we're not just contemplating here in the state of Wisconsin or in the city of Milwaukee, but people around the country are contemplating. Why does it matter that this convention is coming to Milwaukee?
So that's a great question. I think 2016, the role Wisconsin played in 2016 was a big one in different ways. And I think for Democrats, they realized that Wisconsin has always been very important, especially Milwaukee, to their chances each presidential contest. And turnout in Milwaukee was down. And the Democratic candidate, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, she didn't come to campaign personally in the state after the primary. She had an event scheduled, but there was the Pulse nightclub shooting happened, so they canceled the event that day. But she never came back. And I think the optics of that and President Trump winning Wisconsin for the first time a Republican had in 30 years, that's all a big deal, and it's all symbolic. And I think Democrats are choosing Milwaukee because they want to say we still care about this part of the country and it's important to us. And so that's why they're here.
As a local journalist, what are you looking forward to with the DNC?
Yeah, I mean, it'll be crazy. It'll be really interesting to cover. I think we're going to try to find some local angles to the big national nominating contest, but we'll also be covering that and try to find, you know, ultimately who is picked, like how they're connecting with voters here, and whether, you know, the person who is ultimately nominated is the person that wins the primary here, because if they're not, you probably remember Bernie Sanders won the primary in 2016 and Hillary Clinton was the nominee. And was that the reason Wisconsin didn't turn out the way they had before for Democrats? You know, things like that. We'll be looking at those stories.
Yeah. Well, Molly Beck, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thanks for having me.
Molly Beck is the state government and politics reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and we spoke with her as part of our Wisconsin 2020 series. If you have a question about the Democratic National Convention or upcoming election questions, you can submit them on our website, wuwm.com. Coming up, our auto contributor Mark Savage explains how the cold weather can impact your car and what you can do about it. Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Joy Powers. The cold weather isn't just rough for people, it's also rough on cars. Some of us can remember installing engine block or oil pan heaters to make starting the car at least possible on a 40 below zero morning. Then there were the days where the school buses couldn't run because the diesel fuel had frozen. While we're not in a deep freeze at the moment, winter has a long way to go before spring comes. So we're revisiting a segment from last January when Lake Effect auto contributor Mark Savage joined Audrey Nowakowski to give us some tips on getting and keeping our vehicles running in the cold weather.
Mark Savage, welcome back to Lake Effect. Thanks for taking a few minutes to talk.
Absolutely.
So in Wisconsin, it's not just cold, it's becoming frigid, and it's something we haven't quite experienced before. And one thing a lot of people are concerned about is transportation, whether they are taking city buses or driving their cars. So just to start, what are some good tips, you know, safety-wise, mechanical-wise, that people should keep in mind with this cold weather?
Well, I guess the first thing is, if you can put your car in a garage, that's a great thing because it keeps it out of the wind and probably keeps it any, you know, even if it's just a normal non-insulated garage, probably 10 to 15 degrees warmer. So that's the first step. When you start it up, obviously make sure the garage door is open, but, you know, let it run for at least 30 seconds. Let the fluids get mixed around as there, as you want the oil to be coating all the parts that it needs to coat so that you don't hurt your engine. And, you know, obviously drive normally after that, or at least according to the conditions. But key thing here is if you have a newer car, you're going to notice that your check tire light will come on, because as cold weather, especially severe cold weather like we're looking at right now, the air kind of escapes from your tires a little bit, so you're going to lose a pound or two of pressure. I wouldn't worry about it too much unless, you know, you look at your tires and definitely something is a lot lower, then maybe add a little bit too, but don't overinflate, because once it warms up, then the tires that will get some of the air back into them, the you know, the warmth will warm it back up and expand the air. Always have a good battery. Those people who have had bad batteries over the last year or so and have not replaced them, this is the time it should have been replaced by. otherwise, you're going to have trouble starting the car. Because if you can get the battery to fire, really most everything else tends to work after that. You just got to get that little electrical charge in there to get everything fired up. And I think everybody always says, you know, keep liquids topped off and try not to let your gas go below a half a tank and things like that. And I'm sure there's some science behind some of that, but I think it's also just to be a cautionary in case you do get stuck someplace.
Now, for everyone in the city that, say, does have to keep their car parked outside, or when you're at work, you're in an exposed open parking lot, should you take any other precautions, you know, perhaps besides having a shovel in your car and some other things like that? But should we let our cars run a bit longer when it comes to leaving it exposed outdoors for prolonged periods of time before we start driving?
Well, I always think it's good to let it run for a little bit, and you almost have to use your own sense on that. Now there's remote starts. It's nice if you can stand inside and start it and let it go for the minute or two till you get out to it. But I think, you know, you have to watch and see if that heat gauge for the engine heat starts to move a little bit, then you know that things certainly are fine. In severe weather, maybe you're going to let it go for a minute or two before you start driving, but most of the time it just needs to get the fluids moving and not just start it up, throw the car into reverse and get going, because things are still a little bit sticky probably at that point as far as the lubricants that are inside.
Now, would that make a difference? You know, say my car, I got it a couple years ago. It's a newer Nissan Rogue. I'm leaving it outside all day in an open parking lot while I'm working. Does it matter with the fluids and the way precautions should be taken with my car versus someone who is, say, you know, driving an older car that does not have the same engine setups that these newer cars have?
Well, it could be difficult for either one. And why I say that is some of the newer cars, there's so much electronics on them. You never know when maybe the cold weather might affect some of that electronics and therefore make it run differently or make it not want to start because, you know, some little computer chip has blown its brains out because it's a daggone cold. Now, you know, the car makers test all these things and they put them through severe traumas and so forth. But, you know, this is, when it's cold, anything that could be bad could happen is much more likely to happen. So you just want to be careful. And again, don't put extra stress on your car. Try to avoid big bumps when you see them. You don't need to give an extra shock to your shock absorber or springs. Just try and drive a little more carefully. And then if you're parking in a parking lot, one of the things I suggest to folks, if it's possible, is do not park with your nose of your car into the wind, because it tends to, that wind chill that you're feeling, your car is feeling it too. So, you know, park away from the wind if possible, or if there's a building and you can park on one side of it and that protects you a little from the wind, that's a good thing. And I know a lot of people, when it snows and so forth, they raise the windshield wipers so they don't get stuck to the windows. And that's a practical thing, especially if it's snowing. When it's just cold like this, I don't think that matters too much. Maybe carry a rag in your car that you could, you know, maybe a little liquid antifreeze for the windows that you could maybe pour something on if it's already gotten too smeared and it's just not clearing for you because you want to have good visibility. So that's not a bad thing to have. You know, they always tell you to take a blanket and have things like that in the car. None of that's bad. I don't think it's very practical for most of us because we just don't think that way. It's like, well, I'm only going 2 miles or 10 miles or whatever. And then, you know, if you've got an old car, anything you can do to replace, especially belts or things that are going to get more brittle the colder it gets. So a lot of this is preventive maintenance, and probably we should have been talking about this a week or two ago.
But, right, now it's not going to help much.
But at least be aware of that. And that's another thing is when you start the car, those belts are brittle. And, you know, maybe if you don't put a lot of stress on them right away by going extra fast or backing out right away, then you're going to be fine. And, you know, you just don't want to put a lot of stress on them and break that belt right away. Then you do have problems.
Right. We're kind of past the days of having block heaters or dipstick heaters for our cars. So we just need to be a little more gentle, I suppose.
Right. There's still a few folks, I suppose, that have those. And that would be wonderful to have at this time of the year. But it's not very common. And I guess the other thing I would say is if people talk about diesels sometimes at this time of the year. And while sometimes they are a little harder to crank over, once you get them running, they are, you know, like bulletproof this time of the year. So if you live in a really cold climate, sometimes you leave that diesel run all night. And I know that sounds crazy, but I've known from many of my snowmobiling friends that live up in northern Minnesota in the UP that, you know, you lock the car up at night and leave the thing running so that the thing is guaranteed to, and especially usually trucks, guaranteed to be running in the morning when you get out there and are challenged by these, you know, minus 10 and 20 and 30 degree temperatures.
Does that burn a lot of fuel if you're leaving it run overnight but not necessarily moving?
Well, it obviously burns fuel, but it is not a dramatic amount because it is a diesel and they're very efficient in how they you know, burn the fuel oil anyway. So this is probably not the time of the year that people should be worrying quite as much personally about the environment and their car, because the environment has already tossed you a bad scene by giving you a 20 below temperature or whatever. So, you know, do what it takes to survive and make sure you get to where you need to go or to get indoors and stay safe.
Excellent. Great advice. Well, Mark, thanks very much.
All right. Thanks for talking.
Lake Effect contributor Mark Savage writes about cars on his website, savageonwheels.com. His column also appears regularly at WUWM.com. This conversation with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski first aired last January. We'll take one last break, and then we'll have our monthly segment on entrepreneurship. How did you do that? Lake Effect returns in a moment on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. More of Lake Effect now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers, and it's time now for our monthly segment on entrepreneurship.
Hi, I'm Kathleen Gallagher.
Kathleen is the executive director of the Milwaukee Institute, and I'm Tim Keane.
Tim is founder and director of Golden Angel Investors, and this is How Did You Do That? A show about successful entrepreneurs and how and why they succeeded.
I think every client we thought for sure would follow us didn't, and everyone we didn't think would come did. It was really, I think we were really, really surprised.
Lori Hoke graduated first in her class from University of Southern California Law School, worked at two of Milwaukee's biggest law firms, then became in-house counsel for the trust department at Wisconsin's largest bank. She was on track for a comfortable corporate legal career.
Then, however, four money managers who were starting their own firm came calling. At the first meeting, they asked Lori a lot of questions about setting up a new company. And then at the second meeting, they had a few more. And then came the big one. Would she run the firm?
Lori agreed in 2004 to lead Cortina Asset Management while her four partners managed client investments. They grew to 28 employees and $3 billion of assets under management. 15 years later, in the summer of 2019, Silvercrest Asset Management Group bought Cortina for $45 million, plus an additional $26 million if certain benchmarks are met over the next 4 years.
Hey, Lori, welcome to How Did You Do That?
Thank you. Good to be here.
Lori, you grew up in Milwaukee, the daughter of a Milwaukee Public School guidance counselor and a stay-at-home mom. Money was tight. How did this situation breed your work ethic?
Well, my dad worked, like you said, as a middle school guidance counselor, and then he worked in the summers year-round, was just what everybody had to do. And so he worked as a driver's ed teacher in the summer for MPS. And so if we wanted anything, I did gymnastics when I was younger. I paid for it. I worked at Blockbuster Video. I waitressed. I did all the different things because we had money to exist, but that was about it. There was no room for all these other activities that cost money.
So you went to college at the University of Arizona. So
I did.
How'd you wind up there?
Well, I was looking at schools to do gymnastics. And then if you recall the movie Revenge of the Nerds, where they have the big carnival and the sororities and fraternities and all the sports going on, that actually was filmed at U of A. And the day I went to visit was the day it was going on. And I thought, I'm 18 years old or 17 years old at the time. I thought, this is the greatest thing ever. Who wouldn't want to come here? And so by the time I was back home, I picked it and said, okay, we're going. I'm not sure it was the most responsible way to pick a school, but it worked out well and it was fun. And I really, you grow up a lot when you go across the country by yourself.
And was it like the movie?
It was. Oh, yeah. It's still going on today.
You must have been a pretty good gymnast. We went on a gymnastics scholarship, but you blew out your knee shortly into your gymnastics college career. They let you stay there anyway on scholarship. You went to law school at University of Southern California. You got a job clerking in Los Angeles. You were set to live in the West. What made you come back to Wisconsin?
My now husband, who I've known since we were little but just had mutual friends, I was in town for a wedding, and we got to talking, and then we started to talk a little bit when I went back to L.A., and then we talked some more when I came in town, and there was no way my husband was going to move to California. He had never been on a plane before, much less going out to L.A. So I said, all right, I'll give it a chance. I'll come back to Milwaukee, see if I can find anything to do. If not, then what's the worst that happens? I'll go back to L.A. So I'm glad I did. I don't think I would have enjoyed L.A.
So then you built a career as a lawyer that had you in a great job at M&I by age 30. But then the four guys walk in and change everything. Tell us about how you thought about that.
Well, it was funny. Through a mutual friend, they said, can we sit down just to go through what we need to understand if we're going to start our own firm, and what do we need on the compliance and the legal and all of that? So I sat down with them, and then after a couple times of sitting, they said, well, we just want to pick stocks the same way we always did. Will you do everything else? And I thought, wow, what did I say in these last couple of meetings that gave them the impression I was qualified to do that? And then I thought, well, what the heck? What's the worst that happens is we blow up. We don't have any clients after a year, and I have to go back to a big law firm or an in-house job that I feel pretty comfortable I could get. So I said, why not? Let's try it.
So did you said yes right away?
I did.
So then you came home to your husband, who was teaching at a Catholic school, and your twin daughters, who were two. And what was your husband's reaction to the fact that you had just said yes to leaving a good job?
Yeah, I'm not sure how much detail I shared with him at the time. I think it was more of a, hey, I'm going to do a different job, not, hey, I'm risking our entire future for the next 12 months. You know, I was confident enough that I had a backup of I could go back to any of the big law firms if it all was a mess. So,
but these guys had no clients.
No, we had no clients.
Yeah.
So. Nothing. We had nothing. No space, no computers. We did that all.
And against that background, you had one of these wonderful large corporate moments where Em and I walked you out of the building.
Oh, that was fun. I think because Kathleen, you put my name in the Journal Sentinel story at the time.
I remember that story.
Yes.
Just for the record, that was Kathleen that did that.
Yeah.
You did come in and tell me about it,
yes.
I want to be clear.
Apparently, Em and I did not take too kindly to having their chief legal officer's name in the paper as leaving while she was still employed at M&I. So the funny thing is, as an attorney there, I couldn't access any client. I wouldn't even know how to access a client file or anything, but they were a little unhappy with how that was broadcast and my new role, so they boxed my stuff up and escorted me to the elevator. Thankfully, my cube was not too far from the elevator.
You know, it's interesting. Milwaukee has a good share of money managers and money management firms. You guys got advice from Andy Ziegler, who founded Artisan Funds, right?
He
sat down with and
he gave us the list of the four guys. My four partners sat with him for a long time, a couple times, and he gave the list of what not to do. Instead of, everybody can tell you what they would do, but he gave us the list of what not to do. And one of the first things he said is the portfolio managers should just stick to managing money. Don't try to figure out how to settle trades, how to get health insurance for the company, how to set up computers. You go find somebody that does that. You guys do what the clients are paying you to do. So we did that on day one.
Your four partners had a list of clients they thought would follow them from U.S. Bank. And so how did that work out?
I think every client we thought for sure would follow us didn't, and everyone we didn't think would come did. It was really, I think we were really, really surprised. The clients that we thought would be nearly impossible to get were some of the first that came over.
Why was that, do you think?
I think some of it was the types of clients, and some of it was just learning for us, but a lot of the public pension clients we assumed would not move quickly just because it's public, they're more nervous, and those were actually some of the first ones. And I don't know if some of it was luck where there just weren't a lot of good small cap managers and people realized that we had a fortunate time with timing in the market and underperforming managers, and we had a really great track record. And some of it was with public plans, like it's just hard to do anything, and so even if they wanted to sort of fire us, it just takes too long. So we got the benefit of that in the beginning. And then we had great, great numbers the first couple of years. So even the ones that we didn't think would come came pretty quickly.
When you say great numbers, you mean performance numbers.
Yeah.
You know, we should jump in and explain a little. There are stockbrokers who help people choose stocks and bonds or mutual funds. And then there are managers like you guys were who manage big pools of money, and you really take discretion. You make all the decisions about the money for, tell us, like, who would some of the clients be that you would have?
Well, about a third was public pension, so it was either an employee retirement fund of somewhere, and some of those are public, like Florida State's Teachers Fund is one that we had. There's a bunch of foundations, non-public foundations, that are trying to manage their assets so that they can save the foundation and the cash as long as they can and extend it. There was a good amount of public company dollars, whether it be retirement assets or their foundation or just their cash account. So it was kind of a mix. But everything other than we didn't do any of the individual, any of the retail, any of that piece.
So you chose to handle just institutional accounts and not retail. Why is that?
Well, the margin on retail accounts is not great. They are far more difficult clients to deal with because those are generally individuals. They're paying attention on some of them on a daily basis, some of them on an hourly basis on their portfolio. They typically have lower fees. It costs more operationally. So in the beginning, we said we weren't going to go down that path, and we were fortunate enough that we never really had to. Mm. I think if you started a firm today, you'd have to base a huge percent of your clients on that retail chain. But we got lucky and didn't have to do that at all.
And why is that?
Institutional investors now are going more passive. They're just going to index funds, ETFs, different things aside from hiring active managers like us. And so as those clients go away, you have to replace them with something. And so you're seeing more and more people replacing them with retail, whether it be some kind of commingled trust or a retail mutual fund or wrap programs with brokers. It's a huge part of the business now, and it's not a great profitable business.
What made you decide to sell Cortina?
I'd say the last 18 to 24 months, we realized that the institutional space was not growing at all, and it didn't appear to be growing anywhere in the near future either. And so I think we looked and said, let's see what's out there and see if there is a buyer that's a good fit. And once we started that process, there was interest, so we knew the timing was right.
I just want to take it back a little bit, Lori, to when you first started Cortina. You know, you talked about all of the things you had to do to get it set up. You had to get the HR, and you had to set up payroll and the computers, everything else. What were some of the challenges in trying to do that, in trying to start a firm from scratch?
Oh, I mean, there were so many things that you don't realize as smart people that you have to do that you just take for granted when you work in an office. Like, I remember one of the guys and I, we were trying to FedEx a contract to one of the potential clients, and we're standing downstairs at the FedEx box, and we were FedExing it to Madison, and we're looking at it because it says next day air, and we're sitting there saying, well, are they really going to fly it to Madison? Is there like a next day ground? This seems really silly. And, you know, so I've got a guy with an MBA from Chicago, and I have a law degree, and I think we spent 25 minutes trying to decide which envelope to put a FedEx in. Because in all of our careers, I think you just handed it to someone and they FedExed it. So, you know, we had things like that that you never would have, like, never would have dawned on me how to get a FedEx account. And, you know, by the time we figured it all out, it's all fine. But there were so many things like, just silly things like that, that you don't think about. We had people come in the winter with winter coats, and we had no hangers for them. So we were taking one of the guy's shirts that he had dry cleaned that he had in his office. We took the wire hanger from that and we tried to hang a coat on it in the coat closet. And of course it was too heavy to, so we walked back in to get the coats for all these people and they're all on the floor in the coat room. So we're trying to quick pick them up and distract them. So before we even got to like, what kind of computer do you buy? There was so many things that you don't think about, but you know, those are fun things you look back on and say, okay, we went from that to where we are.
What about hiring people? You've got some real definite views about hiring people, right?
Yeah, and I've done, I can tell you as a mom and what my kids are looking at doing, I've totally done a 180 after we started Cortina. I think before when I hired at the bank, I was far more focused on what majors people had, where do they go to school, what's their experience, versus at Cortina, some of the best people, I mean, my one of the guys on the trading desk, who was one of our best employees, was a geology major at Boulder. And somebody gave him a referral to our office, and so we hired him, and he worked out to be great. And I'm guessing, had he not come from someone I knew, I would have sort of looked right past him in a pile of resumes, because what would I do with a geology major? We've got an English major that turned out to be a great compliance person. So I think going forward, I would just try to see what the person can do, talk to them, bring it. I mean, we interviewed almost everybody that sent a resume in for certain positions just to see, because it's hard to tell from a resume nowadays.
You really had to take charge. You had these four highly educated, really smart portfolio managers you had to be the boss of. Was that intimidating? How did you manage that?
Well, I'm sure they wouldn't tell you I was the boss of them.
Actually, they did tell me that many times when I'd call and try and talk to them as a reporter.
I think what really helped with a lot of it is that I own the firm with them. And so I think it would be very difficult if I didn't have skin in the game. So I think what made things much easier was anything I was telling them we had to do made sense, because it was going to hurt me just like it would hurt them, or it would help me just like it would help them. So I think that really helped a lot in terms of getting them to buy into whatever it was that I was saying.
So you thought it would take you about 6 months to find a buyer?
Yes.
And how'd that play out?
About 300% longer than it did. So we hired a banker in February of 18, thinking by that summer we'd have everything done. And we didn't sign until July of this year. So it was about 18 months, just a much longer process. We were looking all over the world, talking to people, more meetings, more follow-up, more data. I just don't think any of the four of us expected it to be that time-consuming and that long of a process.
You're still in your 40s, so not exactly retirement age, but among the buyers you considered, you chose the one that wouldn't have a job for you. The four guys are with the acquirer, but you aren't. What made you go with that idea?
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. We'd go in some of these meetings, and we'd talk about synergies that you could have if you bought us. And whenever I was in the meeting, I said, it's really weird to sort of synergize yourself out of a job when I was the one doing the books and putting all the financials together. And every other buyer that put in a bid, I would have stayed and had probably a fairly key role in. So it was interesting. This was the best fit for everybody. And so you've got to wear that hat as a partner in the firm and not look at just yourself and the effect of a deal on yourself. So this was the best fit. It's a great fit for our employees. It's a great fit for the partners. It was a good price. It made sense for all the reasons.
So any more specific indications of what you might do next?
I don't know. Maybe I'll do private equity. Maybe I'll go be a general counsel. Maybe I'll go nonprofit. No, I really genuinely don't know right now. I have a bunch of different opportunities that people call with. I just am enjoying not having to do anything right now for maybe another month or so.
Whatever you do, it's pretty clear you're willing to take the next risk. So thank you so much for sharing your story with
Thanks,
us.
Thanks, Lori.
Thanks for having me.
You can read more about this story and find links to resources by visiting WUWM.com.
And listen to all our podcasts at WUWM at the iTunes Store or wherever you get your podcasts.
How Did You Do That wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.